using AI to help families and patients with Alzheimer's and dementia. That's our TechStination. I'm Fred Fishkin. Joining us from CareYaya, a health tech startup based in North Carolina, is CEO Neil Shah. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Fred. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. Well, first off, congratulations in being awarded a grant recently from the National Institute on Aging for the work that you're doing. Tell us more about your focus and how you're making use of AI.
Sure. Yeah, great question, Fred. So, you know, we are predominantly helping people who are elders suffering from neurological disorders, you know, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, even recovering from stroke. And we're realizing, you know, our initial AI innovation was a AI-powered marketplace that would dynamically match these folks with caregivers in nearby in their community. So we built that product. And then as we built that product, we realized there was that was just the first inning. There was so much other technology you could bring into the care sessions to really revolutionize and transform the way care is being done in this country. You know, care for many people with neurological disorders just ends up being safety related, companion related. But there isn't a lot of like therapeutic activity related things that traditional care companies are doing. So we thought, okay, this is an open field. You know, to kind of give you a longer answer on that, our initial AI-powered care marketplace was connecting elders who need care at home with college students who are going to the healthcare field to do the care. So, you know, think about your doctors and nurses and physician assistants of tomorrow. So we built that out here very locally in North Carolina. And then in the last like 6 months or so, it's rapidly spread around the country. We now have over 12,000 students at 30 plus universities doing care in their communities. And this inspired the next wave of AI innovation for us, which was, okay, all of these students are today's 20-year-olds at top universities. You know, they're digitally native, very tech-savvy population. How can we arm them with AI-powered tools to improve the care experience? So to the grant that you mentioned, that grant is focused on AI-powered dementia care training. That's one big gap we see in the market. You know, whether it's for student caregivers who are trying to help somebody in their community with dementia, you know, they don't have 100 hours to take a certified nurse aide course and pay $1,000 for that type of curriculum, but they're nice people and they want to help people in their community. So how do we build something for them? And similarly for the family caregiver, you know, if you kind of think about, there are 10 million family caregivers right now in America that are taking care of somebody with dementia, whether it's an aging parent or a spouse. And, you know, these 10 million people, most of them aren't doctors and nurses. You know, they're middle-aged people who are doing something else who suddenly find themselves in the role of a caregiver. And, you know, to add insult to injury, when that happens, the healthcare system doesn't have a solution for them. How do you learn how to become a caregiver? It's like, oh, go take a certified nurse aide class and, you know, spend $1,000 and take 100 hours of videos or in-person training. So we thought, you know, the app that we got this grant from NIH and Johns Hopkins was to build what they call Duolingo. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with that language learning app, Duolingo of dementia care training. How do we use modern methods, personalization, AI to kind of help figure out where your skill level is currently, AI to help figure out what is the need of the person you're caring for, and then deliver you bite-sized micro-learning modules so you can quickly and conveniently get the upskilling that you need without sitting through hours and hours of coursework, which may not be relevant to your specific immediate care need. So that's kind of the first innovation. You know, we were surprised. No one in the market is doing anything like that. And the social impact could be profound, both on training our own student workforce of thousands of students, as well as just on millions of family caregivers out there.
And you're also working to improve the tech literacy among these older adults, sometimes patients?
Yes. Yeah. So that's another, you know, I wrote a big article on this because I think a lot of people are like missing an interesting thing that's happening is that within healthcare technology, the pace of digital health innovation is skyrocketing. Like there's everything from, you know, continuous glucose monitoring, which has obviously now been out there for, you know, 5+ years, to ways smart inhalers for management of chronic conditions like COPD, to a lot of even like tools like we're developing for dementia, Alzheimer's, tools we've developed for Parkinson's. Other people are developing tools using AI and like, you know, kind of modern digital technology for Parkinson's. And, you know, what we find is the biggest gap right now is a lot of tools can help with chronic disease management and improving outcomes. But the population that has the highest prevalence of chronic disease is the above 65 population. And unfortunately, it's also on balance a population that has lower tech proficiency. And so, you know, it kind of wrote an article about this saying that, well, the people who benefit the most are not able to benefit the most. So society needs to do something about it. So we started saying, okay, we have thousands of college students in all these cities. We will make them the kind of tech teachers. So we have students going out in these communities, and we're doing this all over kind of Boston, San Francisco, all over, you know, places like Charleston, South Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, even in our home in North Carolina. And the students are going out in their community at retirement communities, senior living, independent living, assisted living, senior centers, and hosting sessions to teach elders how to use AI tools, you know, everything ranging from simple ChatGPT to some of these specific therapies and, you know, tools we've been developing to how to use virtual reality. You know, I think, you know, you and I have talked extensively about like virtual reality and like the positive impact it can make on people, everything from, you know, the therapeutic recreation to even like physical therapy and things like that, that VR has tremendous power, but elders don't know how to use it themselves. So we have students going out in the community to upskill and teach them. And I think that's going to be a big need because that's the only way they're going to benefit from these tools that are being designed. So
getting the students involved is so important here for a couple of reasons. One is people who may need care, ongoing care. If you have a lot of money, it's not an issue. You can hire people, right? You are trying to democratize this, making it affordable by involving the students. Tell us about that aspect.
Yeah, sure. You know, so right now there is a massive caregiver shortage. And, you know, one of the things we've observed in the traditional care industry, like run by like these local care agencies, you know, is that it's believe it or not, it's a $200 billion industry in terms of the formal care economy. And then if you add the informal economy, Melinda Gates Foundation has a detailed research report on this, it's up to $600 billion. So that's how much like home-based elder care is happening in this country, hundreds of billions. The amount that's happening through tech is less than 1%. Most of it is happening in pen and paper, localized way. So the current industry structure is national franchisors, like care agencies, have brand names and find local franchisees to pay them a franchise fee and then run a local company. And that local franchisee will then, let's say, depending on what, you know, you're in the New Jersey area, I'm in the North Carolina area, but like the rates might vary, but let's say somewhere around, this local franchisee will charge you anywhere between $35 to $50 an hour to get home-based care. And they'll turn around and pay the caregiver less than half of that. So in our state in North Carolina, for example, most home care is around $35 an hour, and most caregivers are getting paid $12, $13 an hour. Most of the money is a big markup that goes to franchise royalties, advertising, sales, marketing, profit, administrative overhead. We think this industry is incredibly, incredibly inefficient. So, you know, you mentioned the affordability angle that, yes, you know, now because of the costs are so high, like let's say in a big city like Boston, San Francisco, the costs are $50 an hour. That really is in realm of like reach of like most of the upper income population only. But I'd go one step further and say, not only that, the quality is very low because the industry structure is so broken and they're underpaying the caregivers so much that most of this money that you pay doesn't go to the person doing 99% of the work. As a result, the caregiver quality is also extremely poor. And you know, you can't blame the caregivers. It's like, if I were in the industry, it's anyone who can get a job anywhere else gets out. You know, people go get a job at Walmart. You know, you can be a cashier at McDonald's. So no one wants to stay in the traditional care industry because of how broken the structure is, because they're doing all the hard work and not getting any of the money. So we thought, okay, there's a society-wide caregiver shortage and it's getting worse. No one is doing this through tech. And this seems kind of like an open field for us. So that's how we entered that. You know, our initial entry was building a tech marketplace where families who need help with care can book online, schedule, pay, do kind of everything online. That would massively reduce the administrative overhead. Zero sales and marketing, by the way. You know, we do zero advertising. It's all word of mouth, you know, thank courtesy of appearances like here on your podcast. It's that we get the word out, but we do no paid advertising because we want to be very ruthlessly efficient about the cost structure. And then we turn around and allow people to book on this marketplace with zero markups, no fees, no add-ons, and literally all the money goes to the student caregiver. So in most markets, we are operating Care AI at $15 to $20 an hour, total cost of care, which is traditionally half of the care industry cost. And then on top of that, because we created this gig-based marketplace, we found there was an amazing pool of caregivers hiding in plain sight, which are today's best and brightest college students, people who want to become doctors, nurses, you know, physician assistants, et cetera. they are not engaged by the care industry. You know, we've done surveys here at Duke University. If you have a senior who's a 3.9 GPA who's going to med school next year, applies to 10 care jobs, will get rejected by all of them because the care companies only want people who can do 40 hours a week. You know, they're really profit maximizing for clients and families, or sorry, for caregivers and families who get a lot of care. So they don't want to operate in the gig economy. So we're like, okay, these caregivers are going to be awesome. They're going to be inherently very motivated, not just for the money, but for the work experience, you know, towards as a future pathway to graduate school. So we are unlocking these by the thousands. We now have over 12,000 students on it. For example, in the Boston area, I mean, it's a no-brainer. You can pay a local care company $50 an hour, and they'll send you somebody who is making a minimum wage who likely is uneducated and may not even want to be there. Or you can pay $20 an hour and get a Harvard pre-med student to come help you. I mean, I think it's a no-brainer, you know, from a consumer choice perspective. So while the initial innovation was meant to democratize access and expand access to kind of lower cost of care for people who are priced out, I also think people who could afford traditional care industry are still choosing to use this just because the care is better and the students are just so much more inherently motivated. And everybody likes to save money.
That said, there are limitations as to what kinds of duties the caregivers, the students are performing or can perform, right?
Yes. Great question. So the limitation is companion care only. So they're not doing any level of clinical care. You know, they're not doing help with bathing, showering. They're not, you know, able to kind of give insulin injections, anything like that. But interestingly, you know, we learned this. So we were chosen by the AARP Age Tech Collaborative as, you know, one of the top caregiving innovations in America last year. And we went through this accelerator program. So they gave us access to a lot of research that AARP does. And one of the interesting statistics is that of the care needs cumulatively, like the cumulative number of hours of care people need above 65, 61% of the care need is companion only. So it's the biggest care market is companion level care. Of course, the more skilled care is a big market and people do need a lot of that. For now, we can't address that. But the companion level care, people are paying an arm and a leg to get that. And, you know, we can really deliver a better product cheaper and more conveniently for people. So, but yes, for now, it's companion only.
You know, you and I met through our mutual friend, the great Mary Furlong, who I do regular podcasts with as well. What's Next? Living Longer, Better, Smarter. What is your background and your motivation for doing this?
Sure. Yeah, great question. My background is actually kind of non-traditional and unique. I fell into caregiving in my mid-30s because I became a caregiver. But prior to this, you know, my quick summary of background is, you know, I grew up in North Carolina, went to school at the University of Pennsylvania, and really wanted to work in business and finance. So right afterwards, I found myself working on Wall Street after college. I did investment banking at Credit Suisse First Boston. And then very quickly got into the world of private equity and hedge funds. By the time I was 27, I became a partner at a multi-billion-dollar fund where I was running a portfolio of investments and had a pretty good track record of investing in different industries, including healthcare and technology. And then by the time I was 31, one of the investors of that fund backed me to start my own fund. So I started that with $10 million. And then by the time I was 35, I was running $250 million of capital, investing across healthcare, technology, and other industries. Public and private, and, you know, was managing capital for family offices, charitable foundations, and university endowments. Unfortunately, starting in my early 30s, I found myself in caregiving, first secondhand, as my grandfather came down with dementia, kidney failure, cancer, and then end-of-life care, and like a very quick succession. And, you know, the caregiving responsibilities, you know, my family took on. And, you know, there was my first foray into learning how broken the home care system was. You know, we tried to get external care help because both my parents were working, I was working, and it was really hard to manage the care. And ultimately, you know, my mom had to drop out of the workforce to take care of him full time because we just felt so guilty about the care options that were available to us. And, you know, unfortunately, after he passed, you know, my mother could not re-enter the workforce because she'd taken, you know, a bunch of time off. So I noticed that firsthand, and then I was still running my fund. So I spent then a year or two researching, okay, there's got to be ways to kind of find companies that are doing cool things here, innovating, you know, given how big the market size is. So I became kind of obsessed with the topic. And then at that point, at the peak of my fund management career, my wife became severely ill and I became her primary caregiver. And, you know, that was initially thought was going to last a few months. It turned out to last over 3 years, bouts of cancer, failed therapies, multiple surgeries. At one point was in a medical coma for a month. So I kept taking sabbaticals from my work to manage her care. And that was like a really firsthand experience where when you can't get good care help and you try to get help and you see low quality, and affordability wasn't even an issue, I would have paid anything. But the quality of the care help wasn't good. You end up feeling really guilty. And, you know, you end up saying, okay, I can do it myself, you know, because it will affect the outcome. So I ended up taking a bunch of sabbaticals from my work and ultimately wound down my fund to be her caregiver full time. Had to move back home to North Carolina to just get help from my family because me doing it full time, I couldn't do it alone. And then at that point, just, you know, thankfully, knock on wood, after multiple years, she finally had a successful outcome and now has been in remission, you know, for 3 years. And at that point, I became obsessed with care. You know, I just thought the care market in the country is broken. You know, my family's from India, and I've observed that, you know, relatively speaking, social care is way better in other countries. You know, healthcare, as like medical care, we have, you know, in the US, healthcare is the best. You know, we have amazing drugs, we have amazing medical procedures, some of the best machines, some of the best doctors. But the social care, home care component, I think in the US is completely broken. I think we have some of the worst social care in the world, especially relative to the wealth of the country. And I think there's no innovation going on, you know, so I just became absolutely obsessed with it. And all those years of dealing with family members' care kind of woke me up to how many 50 plus million Americans are in a situation where they're caring for an aging parent, a seriously ill spouse, even a child with special needs. You know, you see these people all the time when you're kind of like going to hospitals, when you're sitting in ICU, when your own loved one is sick, when you're going to chemotherapy appointments, when you're going to radiation. And you just realize like what's going to happen to these people at home, you know, who's helping. And yeah, so I think it's both a personal passion and then also just kind of like an observation of like how big the opportunity is and how many people are going through this.
Wow. Well, I'm so glad to hear that your wife is doing better. And this is an issue that affects, I think, all of us at one time or another, if you live long enough.
So exactly.
Tell us about some of the latest innovation in AI that you're seeing today that maybe you're working with that people are going to find exciting.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of the coolest innovations we're seeing are around like therapeutics. You know, like I think that there is an emerging field of like digital therapeutics, which, you know, therapeutics has a loosely defined, you know, it doesn't mean a drug, you know, but things that can improve quality of life, improve mental health, improve cognitive health, and hopefully even potentially improve physical health for these populations. So we focus a lot on neurological care because that's where we see a big gap. So people with dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, you know, recovering from stroke, et cetera. And I'll tell you like some of the cool AI things we've been doing are, there's like a fairly simple AI tool that we built in a matter of like a few months, but basically art therapy. You know, so that's a therapeutic activity that a lot of people are doing who historically have had like, let's say Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, and, you know, somebody would guide you in creating art. And people find that very relaxing. Oftentimes it's helpful for people's motor skills and motor skill redevelopment. It's great for mental health, especially when you're kind of in these neurodegenerative disorders. It's a great way to express, you know, kind of what you're feeling, oftentimes express pain levels, express, you know, emotions, things you're thinking about as you lose other communication abilities. But there's a shortage of art therapists. And we realize that kind of across the board. You know, even a lot of people are on hospice and there's a shortage of art therapists for people who are literally at end of life, trying to wait to get art therapy and can't get it. So we developed a AI-powered art therapy tool, which simply can be done on a touchscreen laptop or an iPad. You know, let's say an initial test case there was a 90-year-old lady with Parkinson's. And, you know, she has reasonably severe tremors, but she used the love to create art and, you know, finds it very calming and therapeutic. So, you know, basically she could draw assisted by a student or somebody nearby who would just type in kind of like what she's trying to draw. And then she would draw on the iPad and whatever outlines or shapes she draws, generative art AI would just fill in the gaps and make like a cool looking kind of rendition. Like to me and you, this might be like kind of like simple. Like I played around with this tool and it's like, yeah, fun. But after a few minutes, you know, you're kind of like, you know, you get bored. But it's because we have the luxury of like we can, you know, draw like very intricate things by ourselves. You know, to people like Mary, this is a home run, you know, in terms of like, there's a act of creation that now she can participate in. And we've noticed, you know, her whole family has been like, she's just way more lively, way more animated, looking forward to using these types of tools. So we've now rolled that out and we've done kind of like art therapy for tons of people with dementia, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, even recovering from stroke and happening in kind of one-on-one care settings. We've just allowed a bunch of senior centers, assisted living communities to use the tool. And yeah, I mean, it's just awesome to see the impact. So that's kind of like a where I think there's like a relatively straightforward innovation that doesn't take years and years of research, but has a massive social impact. On the other complete end of the spectrum is something that we've been prototyping, which I think has a ton of potential, but is also like a ton of work. And this is basically reading your mind. So we've been messing around with a lot of neurotech devices, what they would call like brain-computer interface, and trying to decode the thoughts of people with dementia, people post-stroke, people with more advanced Parkinson's, who've lost the ability to verbally communicate. You know, if you kind of think about like the way the brain structure works, and you know, I think a lot of people misunderstand in neurological care that it's not that the person doesn't have complexity of thought anymore. It's that the link between the part of your brain where you're thinking, you know, your thoughts, desires, actions you want to take, that compared to you being able to use the part of your brain that is able to verbalize them and get them out of your mouth or write them down, those links become severed or weaker. So now you're just trapped in your own mind. So we developed a tool using neurotech devices like brain computer interface, like Muse headband, which is clinically validated, to then build basically AI and machine learning algorithms to be able to train the models and then guess at what you're thinking about. And the power of that is enormous because a lot of these people end up getting agitated because they can't communicate what they want to do. Like, let's say if you want to eat lunch versus if you want to go to the bathroom versus you want to put a sweater on because you're cold, you know, like within things like dementia, that ends up becoming a big source of agitation where you can't get the word out. Your caregiver, you know, whether it's your family member or a paid caregiver, is just sitting there guessing, what do you want? And then you can't say what you want. So they guess wrong and they bring you lunch when you really want to go to the bathroom. And then it becomes kind of like you get more agitated and the caregiver wonders, why are you agitated? So, you know, creating ways for people who are not able to communicate to then be able to communicate again could be a game changer. So the inspiration of that innovation was we'd seen a couple of big research projects come out of that. There was a paper out of China, the Tencent AI Labs and Tsinghua University put this out. It's called Dream Diffusion, where they're using traditional EEG machines to be able to decode thoughts and turn thoughts into words and images of what the person wanted to do. And they open source the code on GitHub, which is like just awesome public service. So then you could kind of build off that. Then a few months later, so this came out in like July last year. Then a few months later, Meta, you know, also known as Facebook, out of California, they put out Meta AI Labs, put out a huge research paper on using magnetoencephalography, so MEG, which is like very expensive technology. It's like $2 million per machine. And they're able to real time decode thoughts into full images of what the person's thinking about. So like huge applications, but very expensive. You know, the Tencent lab in China, you know, their application was on $100,000 EEG machines. The Meta application was on $2 million MEG machines. So we were like, okay, well, we can build off this, but this isn't going to help anyone because it's way too expensive. It's going to either help only super rich people or be happening at labs. But we're like, how can we help people at home? So we started spending a lot of time looking at this and realized mobile EEG devices have now been effectively consumerized. And Muse out of Canada is probably the leader in this, but they've consumerized it to the point where you can buy and I don't have this here. I have it actually in my other office, but there's a small thin headband you can put on your head that you can buy for $300 online that has 7 electrodes and it can read brainwaves. And it's been clinically validated. People are using it for meditation and kind of stress relief and, you know, management of, you know, mood, but you can real time fully download the 5 major frequencies of brainwaves, and then build AI algorithms to figure out things like, you know, thought. What types of words are you thinking? So we basically decided, why don't we build off the Tencent and Meta innovations and bring something affordable to consumers using mobile EEG? So we've been training AI models on, like, let's say, and actually the coolest part about this project is being led by a daughter of somebody with dementia. So she's actually initially was helping her mother restore communication ability by like showing her an orange and then figuring out what brainwaves are correlating to that, then showing her an apple, figuring that out. And like over time has been training the model and has now gotten it, you know, to the point where you can kind of figure out what objects mom is thinking about, you know, without showing the object. So this is like a fairly rudimentary prototype of the innovation, but the potential of this is enormous. If you can get a $300 device into people's homes that helps non-communicative people be able to communicate even directionally of like the intent of what they want to do, it could be a game changer for dementia care, you know, any neurologic care, stroke care, Parkinson's care, et cetera. So that's like on the cutting edge of AI innovation, but that's also like a ton of hard work between here and there.
Very exciting. Turning thoughts into communication.
Exactly. Exactly.
Without the invasiveness of, say, what Elon Musk is doing with Neuralink, right? Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think that the chip implant thing, it freaks me out a little bit. I mean, I think that, you know, there is application there also for similar, but I think there's way greater risks. I think with a non-invasive device on your head with electrodes, I mean, it's like the least risky way to do it. But yes, you're right. That's one of the big, I think, consumer benefits is there's ways to do it non-invasively.
Well, congratulations on so much innovation that's taking place there. Where can people go for more information?
Thanks. Yeah, you can always visit us at careyaya.org. It's www.careyaya.org. And also, you can connect with us on LinkedIn. I'm reasonably active on LinkedIn. So it's Neal, N-E-A-L, and then my middle initial K, and then last name Shah, S-H-A-H, and at Careyaya Health Technologies. But we love to hear from people. We're always looking for people to collaborate with. So if there are neurologists and, you know, practitioners in the field that have ideas and want to collaborate with us on any of these innovations, if there's senior centers, assisted living communities, you know, that want to collaborate to bring this to people. And then also just if there's people out there listening who are going through care needs within their own family, and you want help with care, we have now expanded to, yeah, over, you know, 30 something cities, and we're rapidly growing all across America. So if you want us to bring Careyaya into your area and there's a reasonably sized university nearby, we'd be happy to build because we think we can help a lot of people.
Just terrific. Neal Shah, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Great. Yeah, Fred, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.